patient came to me with a large hole in his abdomen caused by a fire poker used on him by his wife. He almost bled to death and gangrene had set in. I didn't give him much of a chance. There were other complications. The man had cancer, tuberculosis, leprosy, and a touch of the grip. I decided...
Podcast.
Now, no Novocaine. It dulls the senses.
This is gonna hurt you more than it is me.
Oh, goody, goody, here it comes. Oh, my God, don't stop now!
Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast.
Who is it?
Pizza delivery.
Come in.
Describe what
Jack Mangan
looks like.
Deadpan.
Say
deadpan
again. Say
deadpan
again. I dare you. I double dare you, motherfucker. Say
deadpan
one more goddamn time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Deadpan number 106. I'm your host Jack Mangan, aka the contents of Al Capone's vaults. Apologies if any of the content in this episode sounds rushed or hastily edited, but I wore buttonfly jeans today and so didn't have quite as much free time. There are a bunch of things I wanted to do in this episode, a bunch of things I wanted to talk about, but really there's just so much content and some of it has been backlogged and I hate to say the word neglected, because that wasn't the case, but I don't know. Anyway, so got tons of great content from you guys, and all right, this intro babble really sucks. Enough.
You're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan.
He's bringing sexy back.
That's right. Yo, what's up?
It's Demi
and NG. We're here to rep our podcast, the company. It's all about heroes. That show really rules. And we be spitting so much fire, we make others look like fools. I know we be rapping like it's 1995.
Seriously, please listen to our show.
Yeah, www.thecompanypodcast.net.
Yes, it is that website. Thank you.
And quit talking that jive.
Hello, this is the Energizer Bunny, and this is the contents of my belly button. First of all, my belly button is an innie. It doesn't have any lint in it because it's not all covered in hair, unlike my husband's. I love you, dear. So we first look at it, and at the bottom edge of my belly button is a tiny scar from some surgery I had done quite some time ago. And then we look inside, and there is a mole. Why is there a mole? Because why should that be the only part of my body without one? And that was the exciting contents of my belly button. Bye!
This is a test of the emergency deadpan network. If this had been an actual emergency, you would have been, I suppose, tuned to Jack.
Peter Piper picked and packed a pack of pickled pork nipples. Nipples of pork pickled and packed did Peter Piper pick. If Peter Piper didn't pack his pick of pickled pork nipples, then the people's papers would proceed to appear at Peter Piper's prick.
Whew. Let's hear that on double speed.
This is SB, aka Smooth Like Butter. You're listening to Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast. This right here is the gayest fucking thing you've ever spent 20 seconds listening to. Anybody who likes it is a homo. Deadpan is the fucking way.
Tales from the Deadpan Bar. The Origin Story by Paul Mackey. It was a hopping day at the Deadpan Bar. The weather had finally begun to turn colder, and the days were often cloudy, with the kind of drizzle that desperately wants to become snow, but isn't quite yet. Joe was tending bar, Jack was serving tables drinks, Chris was moving from the kitchen to table service and back again as quickly as possible. The place was mobbed this noon hour. Word of mouth is a funny thing, thought Jack. In the small section of his brain that wasn't already devoted to a half a dozen other things, drink orders, lists of tap selections, is table 4 going to walk out on the check? Is table 6 okay to drive? Is table 2 really a couple of 21-year-olds? Actually, life is a funny thing. Leave word of mouth for later in the consideration. Leaving the rat race with a comfortable chunk of capital, Jack had sought out the place he was now in to just unspool for a while. A small town in a box canyon, the end of a road to nowhere. A main street and a dozen streets of residential. Sleepy was barely even adequate. Jack was drawn there. Renting a small suite of rooms over an abandoned storefront and renovating them into a living space in exchange for rent credits was just the thing. Ringing phones replaced by rewiring, email alerts replaced with replastering walls and ceilings, conference calls replaced by painting and woodwork carpentry. Days began with coffee and supply inventory, lunch was spent with planning the next step, and dinner was a beer and some television or a good book. Life was suddenly simpler. Idyllic. Then one day Jack was working on installing shelving in an odd recess next to the bathroom, when his hammer slipped and went directly through the wall. Cold air blew through the hole. He couldn't see daylight, so he wasn't sure just what was on the other side. He couldn't see anything through the hammer hole, so he went to get a flashlight. The flashlight revealed that the recess was an old, covered-over doorway. The light glinted for a second, and Jack was surprised to see the door was still there, and had either never been closed when they covered it, or more likely had fallen open some time in the past. There was a very dark, short hallway that turned toward the front of the building. Jack felt it very likely there was a stairway to the first floor down that hallway. Jack had gone down to see the real estate agent in the building next door, but she was out of the office. He saw old Mrs. Pomeroy in the flower shop, and went in on an impulse. He asked about the building he was living in and got a lengthy description of back when the mine in the back of the canyon was open, and the sawmill running, and all the shops on Main Street. The flower shop he was in, combined with the real estate office next to it, had previously been a general store. The building on the other side of Jack's was the old bank. That's why the walls are so thick. She began sorting some dried flowers, and looked up surprised when Jack cleared his throat as if she had forgotten he was there. He politely asked again about his own building, and she finally told him it had been a tavern.
Hi, this is Anya from Buffy Between the Lines, the audio drama, and you're listening to Jack Manga's Deadpan Podcast. Deadpan is the way. I left out that one word, is that okay? I mean, I've seen all manner of customs, and you really don't want to know what some demons do with their mothers. I just have sex with Xander. And where's my paycheck? What?
Of course, it was really just an old bar, explained the real estate agent later. Mrs. Pomeroy had also used the term mercantile to describe the old grocery. There was nothing remarkable, just an old bar that had eventually failed with the rest of the town, boarded up and forgotten. Could Jack have a look around? Of course, but the owner of the building had no plans for it. The bar was a mess, all manner of evidence of rodentia, water damage, peeling paint, and warped floorboards. The cellar and storeroom were worse, if possible. In the back room, a door opened into a stairway to the upper floor. Jack had brought his flashlight, and he followed the creaky steps with rubber treads up until he could see the light from his apartment and faintly smell the bread in his bread machine. Then one day, down the interstate in the Home Depot, Jack stood brushing paint chips out of his hair, waiting for an orange-aproned stoner to find someone qualified to run a forklift. Another guy approached. Jack recognized him as another regular, having made multiple trips to this same store many times over the last 10 months or so. The guy's name was Thomas, and he was renovating his basement to better accommodate his homebrew hobby. When Jack said he had bought a building and was restoring a bar, Thomas lit up, and Jack invited him by. So, life goes forward 6 to 8 months, and the place is open. Finally. Jack has been laying down the cash day after day. The basement is ideal for the kegs, but all the linkages and the new 16-head tap set was a pretty penny. All the hard work is done, and now Jack gets to get some money. And he gets it. Some money. And it's a nice life, running a sleepy bar in a sleepy town, playing a show when he feels like it. Thomas starts a brewing operation up the hill in the old sawmill, using the entry tunnel of one of the old mines as well. Then Mrs. Pomeroy passed, and after all the siblings fought over who had to run a floral business that had been in operation for many years but no one actually wanted to run, Jack annexed it for a working kitchen, and Chris came on board in there. Then continued good times, certainly not successful, but pleasant, working with good people, selling good beer, good food. A warm, friendly place with loyal regulars and outstanding atmosphere. And that's when word of mouth clicked. Someone from out of town, a regular's relative or someone who just got a little lost, who it was doesn't matter. Hey, this place has good beer. You like beer, right? There was an uptick as people discovered the little place with a nice set of microbrews and some locally made exotics. Thomas made mini batches, and whenever a cask of something exceptionally rare was to go on sale, some folks started driving up from the city just for the beer. Jack always played on those nights, and some people started noticing, too. Hey, I went up for a beer sampling, and there was this guy playing. And it wasn't long before the foodies took note. Now, today, as folks were going from the city to the slopes for the first actual powder and some man-made base, they were pulling off at exit 243 with no town named, heading up to the Little Box Canyon, and stopping off at the Deadpan for lunch. This has been Tales from the Deadpan Bar, The Origin Story, by Paul Mackey, read by the author. You can contact me by email, reallybigthings@gmail.com, or just stop by the Deadpan and leave a comment. I'm usually in the comment section.
This is Deadpan.
I'd like to take a moment to speak a few words in honor of the great 1970s Orthodox Jewish punk band, the Sex Gefilters, who took London clubs and synagogues by storm with their rousing anthems, God Save Mo Green, No Kosher, Pretty Verklempt, and Anarchy in Long Island, from their one and only album released, Never Mind the Matzo Ball Ox, here's the Sex Gefilters. Johnny Rottenstein, Sid Viciousberg, Steve Goldjones, and Paul Schnuck were heroes to a generation of Orthodox punks with yarmulkes in their mohawks. Though their film, The Great Rock and Roll Gentile, would become a Hollywood success, their menorah would burn, sadly, for only a brief time. That Shlemiel Sid got into a mutually self-destructive involvement with Schlemazel, Nancy Spungenowicz, which would eventually lead to the breakup of the band, and later to his tragic death. But forget about their downfall. Forget the contemporary Jewish punk wannabes like Greenberg Day and the Chaim 182. Let's go back in time and take 140 steps on the slam dance floor to the true classic Jewish punk rockers, like the Ramonsteins, Generation X, the Circle Goyims, and the Sex Gefilters. Okay, are you close-minded enough to find that offensive? Then replace the last bit with one about an elitist Republican whitey punk band, with John W. Rottenton III and his boarding school chum Sid Kennedy Vicious putting out the album Never Mind the Lower Classes, Here's the Sex Palins. Okay, if you don't like the mention of Sarah Palin. With John W. Rottenton III and his boarding school chum Sid Kennedy Vicious putting out the album Never Mind the Lower Classes, Here's the Sex Hiltons.
Stolen from the...
Hey, Mr. Mangan. Got you some lyrics. Fell out the back of the truck.
I've come across a desert to greet you with a smile. My camel looks so tired, it's hardly worth my while. To tell you of my travels across the Golden East, I see your preparations. Invite me first to feast. Take me, I'm yours, because dreams are made of this. Forever there'll be a heaven in your kiss. Amusing belly dancers distract me from my wine. Across Tibetan mountains are memories of mine. I've stood some ghostly moments with natives in the hills. Recorded here on paper, my chills and thrills and spills. Take me, I'm yours, because dreams are made of this. Forever there'll be a heaven in your kiss. And those lyrics was from the Squeeze song, Take Me, I'm Yours, which came out in 1978. So that's drawn from the 70s.
You've got the touch. You've got the power. After all is said and done, you never walk, you never run. You're a winner. You got the moves, you know the streets. You break the rules, you take the heat. You're nobody's fool. You're at your best when the going gets rough. You've been put to the test, but it's never enough. You've got the touch. You've got the power. When all hell's breaking loose, you'll be riding the eye of the storm. You got the heart. You got the motion. You know when things are getting too tough. You've got the touch. You never bend. You never break. You seem to know just what it takes. You're a fighter. It's in your blood. It's in the will. It's in the mighty hands of steel. The touch. Artist Stan Bush.
50 men, all lost at sea. All of them drunk, except for me. 'Twas I who had to face the storm, with nothing in sight to keep me warm. Yo ho, ho ho, over the raging sea we go. Yo ho, ho ho, wherever the four winds blow. That was from Garfield's Halloween Adventure, 1985.
The subject,
Jack Mangan,
was booked under Section 601, in danger of leading an idle, dissolute, or immoral life.
My name is Jem, and I can fly. I didn't always know how, but after my mommy flew away, I discovered I have this secret power. All I do is ride my bike. The faster I pedal, the higher I fly. Someday I'm going to fly to her. My school bus is passing the old amusement park in our town. The school bus goes past it every day. The old Ferris wheel is rusting, and the old roller coaster is falling down. Mommy said the park closed before I was born. She said flying in airplanes is like riding on a roller coaster. She was flying in an airplane when she went away. Mommy was a pilot, and she just loved flying her little airplane from our town's little airport. Even more, she just loved to fly. That's how I know she flew away after the airplane crashed. My daddy said she's an angel now, and angels fly high. The bus is stopping, and it's time to get off. My daddy says he can't afford daycare, so my grandma watches me after school, even though she's old. The bus leaves with smelly fumes. I wave to my grandma, and she waves back. I think I'll get on my bike and practice flying. Grandma lets me ride around the block. We live in a safe neighborhood. I can fly pretty high when I go around the block, especially at the hill. I'm flying right now, but I can't fly high enough to see any angels. I miss my mommy, and I want to see her. I need to fly higher. I have an idea. It was a long ride to get to the amusement park, but I'm finally here. There's a hole in the fence, but I'll just fly over the top. I'm flying around the amusement park, but I can't fly very high because I can't find any hills. The only hill I see is the old roller coaster. That hill is big enough to let me fly to the angels. I'm trying to fly to the top, but I can't fly high enough, so I'm flying around the roller coaster to find another way up. I see some stairs going to the top. I land my bike partway up the stairs, and I have to pull it the rest of the way. I'm at the top. The hill looks perfect. It's very steep. I know this hill will make me go fast enough to fly as high as the angels. Then I'll catch up with my mommy. I'm not scared at all, sitting on my bike at the top of the roller coaster track. I give a good push with my feet and hold on tight. I don't even have to pedal. Faster, faster I go. I'm flying! I'm flying! I see angels! That was I Can Fly by Rick Novi, as read by the author. I Can Fly first appeared in The Written Word online magazine in the July 2008 issue. For more information on Rick Novi and his work, see www.ricknovi.com. www.ricknovi.com.
Jack Mangan's Deadpan Podcast.
It grows like a cold sore from the lip.
Climb! Live! 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 Live!
Greasy Spoon Nipples Game.
I have no idea what the nipple standings is, but nipple standing is always a good thing. First comment, which is actually nipple. Ditto says, Retro, colon. There are 4 entrances to that room. You need to go to each door, get jumped by the commandos, and eliminate them. Try to stay out of view of the witch as well. Once you've eliminated all 4 groups, the rest is easy. I tended to use the DOT, parentheses damage over time, close parentheses rounds, usually incendiary. Save a couple of different types of ammo, and switch when you find out what enemies you were dealing with, parentheses robots, creatures, people, close parentheses. SB says, Good one, Jack. A blogger friend of mine pointed out that Rush Limbaugh was ranting yesterday, or Friday, about the fact that we cannot call Obama African-American because he is from the Arab part of Africa. The Smarty Hottie says, LOL dot dot, Hugh was so cute, smiley face. Okay, where were we? Jack wants to know how to live happily in this fucking world. He has a couple of changes. Hugh says, I fear change. Vanamon says, Google is a wonderful thing, but I can't find a poem that talks about Schrodinger's cat in the style of Dr. Seuss. Sigh. The 5th and final nipple of the week. Jeremy from Seattle says, Theremin's for the win. I activated my genius on iTunes Ellipsis, admittedly with much trepidation. But it really makes really good playlists, Ellipsis.
You don't know the power of a
deadpan.
Alright, so as it turns out, I guess this was the fiction episode. Because we've had 2 contributions so far, and we actually have the questers from FPM will continue in this episode. And actually, it's going to be a 2-parter. So you'll hear the first part in about 30 seconds as soon as I can stop outro babbling. And then the second part will be in the very next episode, along with a ton of other excellent content that I have not yet played. So if you hear your stuff, Tosis, for example, or Paul Mackey's Dumbass Memory, then it will happen in the next episode, which will most likely be next week. Otherwise, you're still welcome to send me stuff. I didn't get a single voicemail this week, so call me. 206-350-TOMI, 206-350-8664. Email me your stuff. You can record it yourself and email it to me. SphericalJackM@gmail.com. And I guess that's not even fun anymore. The M thing. And that's about it. We're not doing greasy jelly beans this week. Feels a little weird, but, you know, that's all right. We do have a comment goal. Your comments goal is 499. And just one last little bit. As it turns out, the community is as strong as ever, and the commenting group is as strong and as good and as excellent as ever. But as it turns out, I'm told by the Farpoint Media powers that be that Deadpan actually gets really pretty respectable download numbers. And apparently we're huge in Germany. So, ich bin ein Berliner, Achtung, mein Lieben. There you go, I hope you all enjoyed that. Alright, I'm going to stop outro babbling, and we're going to get to the questers from FPM and follow that up with some music. And it's actually the questers from FPM number 2, part 1. You know, I for one appreciate what she does and what all of you guys do for Deadpan. Even if all you do is download, I appreciate what you do. But if you contribute to the comments page, that also makes me happy. And if you contribute material for the episodes, that makes me happy. So, this is a good community. Deadpan is the motherfucking way. Thanks for tuning in. You guys rock. Good night, Marsh.
The Questers from FPM, a serial by Amy Bowen. Episode 2, The House of the Sophia Pulchra. As the questing party walked, the gravel path they had found themselves on several minutes ago widened into a road. The glossy black surface on either side of the road, which had originally appeared infinite and featureless, now folded and stretched upward in the distance, forming jagged mountain peaks. A building by the side of the road grew closer and closer. When they reached it, they stopped outside it to look. It was a majestic, 2-story, Gothic-style mansion, with every one of its windows and doors in the shape of a pointed arch. The walls were black, but the frames of the windows and doors and the decorative moldings were white. A sweeping lawn and a gently curving path lined with colorful flowers led up to the open front door. The golden light emanating from the door and windows made the house look welcoming.
"You know, we never did get to have dinner,"
said Ed.
"Why don't we go in and ask if they have anything to eat here?"
"Is that safe, Freya?" asked Amy. "Do we get trapped in the underworld if we eat the food here?"
"No,"
said Rhea.
"You don't get trapped, but when you return to the living world, you'll feel like you didn't eat anything for the whole time you were here."
"Man, that sucks,"
said Joe. "We can deal with it when we get back. There are more fish and green onions where that last batch came from, right?" Rhea and those party members who had been fishing confirmed this, and everyone agreed that they were still tired from the day's journey, so they decided to go and investigate the hospitality of this house and its residents. When they got to the front door, John Bowes peeked around it into a wide, high-ceilinged hallway.
"Excuse me, but is anyone home?"
A woman appeared from a doorway on the right side of the hall, hurried to the door, and opened it all the way. "Oh, guests!" she exclaimed. "So nice to meet you all." The woman had lightly tanned skin, blue eyes, and black hair that fell in rich curls from beneath a tiara studded with diamonds and rubies. She wore a short, deep red, halter-top dress that revealed an impressive amount of cleavage and dangerous-looking high heels. "My name is Andrea," she said. "Welcome to the House of the Sophia Pulchra. Please, come inside. We were just sitting down to dinner."
"Thank you. We will. We were hoping you would be kind enough to spare a meal for us travelers."
"Of course. We love having company here." Andrea led the group into the room John had seen her come out of, which was the dining room. Energetic, intricate music was playing softly in the background. A long, heavy oak table with seven chairs on each side and one at each end dominated the room. There was a full set of silverware, glasses, and a napkin at every seat. Two men sat near the center of the table on one side, and another woman sat across from one of them. "We have guests, everyone," Andrea announced happily. Those who were seated at the table got up. Andrea introduced them to the guests as Hugh, her husband, and Alvy and Addie, their apprentices. The guests introduced themselves to their hosts as they took seats around the table. "Are you a vegetarian, Rhea?" Andrea asked the rabbit, who was on the table next to one of the place settings.
"No, actually. I've taken a few lessons from the rabbit of Karabenog."
"That's why I leave her alone,"
added Wanderwolf. "Oh, is anyone else a vegetarian?" Everyone shook their heads. Andrea clapped her hands twice and called out, 11 for dinner!" A moment later, a flock of glossy feathered ravens came flying out of the doorway at one of the narrow ends of the room. Each one was carrying a silver tray of food by a long, arched handle. They set their trays down in front of the diners at the table, then returned to the kitchen. "Enjoy!" There was a different dinner in front of each person at the table. Ed and Rhea both had steaks. John had what appeared to be a very large, bluish bird leg with fluorescent yellow gravy. He looked at it with an expression that changed from incomprehension to surprise to pleasure in the space of a few moments. "What in the world is that?" inquired Jeremy.
"It's a bird leg. This is something straight out of my strange imagination. I didn't think they were real."
"The thoughts in your mind influence what you get for dinner around here," explained Hugh. "It's a very convenient way of ordering." All the dinners, including John's, proved to be delicious. The ravens flew around, serving rich red wine and any other drink that the diners requested. The walls of the dining room, like the walls of the hallway, were decorated with beautiful paintings and photographs. Some were abstract, some were landscapes, others were of couples engaged in intimate activities.
"You have the most remarkable collection of art."
"Thank you," said Hugh. "Everything you see here is our own work. Making art is our favorite thing to do together. Second favorite thing, corrected Andrea wickedly. She and Hugh both chuckled.
Are you and Addie apprenticing as artists then, Alvy?
Sort of. We are learning the ways of wisdom and beauty from the keepers of one of the underworld's largest collections of those two things. Oh, I see, said Amy. In Latin, Sophia means wisdom and pulchra means beautiful. So do you two call yourselves the Sophia Pulchra because you're keepers of those two things? Yes, said Andrea. The artwork you see here is just a tiny sample of our portfolio. There's a lot of it because of the natural magnet for beauty and wisdom in our house. For every day we spend sorting through the stuff, we have to spend 5 days creating art to express what we've learned. We wouldn't want it any other way, though, said Hugh. And, with Alvy and Daddy helping us, we can get almost twice as much cataloging done in a day as we did without them.
Why is all that wisdom and beauty attracted to your house?
It was gathering here before there was a house here. We decided to live here and take charge of collecting it and keeping track of it, since no one else was.
Oh, that's good. I was afraid you might be evil.
Nope, we're just chaotic neutrals. There is a company in the neighborhood called Evil Incorporated, but we don't have anything to do with it. I work for the Celestial Bureau of Trade, added Hugh. Completely different industry, and also a neutral power.
That would explain the mansion. It's very nice, by the way.
Thank you. You're all welcome to stop here for the night if you want to. We have plenty of room for passing adventurers. Thank you, said Amy. We accept. The others agreed. The questers settled into guest bedrooms for the night. Rhea slept on a silk pillow at the foot of Amy's bed. Even though they were guests in a house, the warriors of the party kept their usual night watches. They were living people visiting the underworld, which meant that they were vulnerable to beings less friendly and less sapient than their hosts, beings who were drawn to the warmth and energy of their living bodies and would gladly trap them here. Thus, Joe, Jeremy, and Wanderwolf claimed the rooms nearest the ends of the hall, and each spent a third of the night awake, watching for any attack on their companions. They never heard the faint, pulsating humming that awakened John Bowes in the middle of the night, nor did they feel the irresistible surge of curiosity that suddenly seized his mind.
Down like eyes upon me. on you. The sunrise fades to blue, and I choose again to share this fine light with you. And I swim in the darkness of your eyes.
Quit talking that jive.